This is Derek Bros. This is Derek Bros of the Conscious Resistance. I'm here in Standing Rock.
That man is wanted in 5 different countries: Chile, Argentina, Brazil.
We've been fighting a long time. We've all lost so very much. So many loved ones gone.
Don't you fucking tease that horse!
You are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important.
Hey everyone, this is Derek Bros with the Conscious Resistance Network. Today is Friday, February 25th, 2022, and tonight we are going to be talking about some really important topics based on an article that I just released for The Last American Vagabond. Ryan, of course, thelastamericanvagabond.com. I know a lot of you guys know his work. I write there regularly and I'm back to writing, so I've just produced this article. It's about 4,000, almost 5,000 words. I encourage you to check it out. We'll be going over that in detail today. And I'm excited to check this out because it's a really important topic. We're going to focus on some of the words and the thoughts of Ted Kaczynski, who is the Unabomber. Those of you in the United States know what that's about. We'll talk about that. And we're going to look at some of his warnings and his words in relation to social credit scores, in relation to this so-called impact financing, impact investing, social impact finance. These really kind of obscure financial tools that I don't think most people are even aware of, and they're really important to understand. So we're going to dive deep into that today. But before we do that, I want to remind you guys to bookmark my website, theconsciousresistance.com. That is theconsciousresistance.com. Guys, we recently launched version 3.0 of the website. You can find all of the content, everything there, from documentaries, books, essays, articles, interviews, my podcast, The Activation. We've got more and more content in Spanish coming up. So check all that out. You can find out more about the philosophy behind my work and so much more. So check that out, theconsciousresistance.com, and sign up for our email newsletter. I also want to remind you guys that I am, as of 2022, no longer on PayPal or Patreon. There's no digital way to support me other than crypto. So if you would like to support me, though, maybe you used to support me on Patreon or used to maybe send money to me through PayPal or other means. If you want to do that, we now have a P.O. box, which is listed on theconsciousresistance.com/invest. And then there's all of our crypto wallets for those of you who deal in crypto, if you want to support our efforts and our work. So let's go ahead and let's get into this article here. Again, I write regularly for thelastamericanvagabond.com. If you're not familiar with Ryan's work at The Last American Vagabond, or Taylor, or Robert, and myself, and occasionally Whitney Webb as well writes for The Last American Vagabond, I encourage you to get caught up and to see the amazing work being done by these team of people. And I'm thankful to be involved and to be a part of this team. I also want to mention, if you're watching on Facebook, we are also currently live on Odyssey. We're live on Rockfin. We're live on DLive. And I think we're live on Float. So there are 4 other places right now to watch this content outside of Facebook. And if you know Facebook censors people, then I encourage you to not support them by watching on another platform right now. And speaking of that, let's go ahead and get into talking about how technology and the idea of big tech, how that's going to be implemented at a level that we can't even really imagine right now. I mean, it really is beyond the imagination. But let's go ahead and dive into this. This is my article, published at thelastamericanvagabond.com, The Coming Terror of Social Impact Finance and Social Credit Scores. So we are basically going to go through every piece of this article. I'm not going to read the specific, I'm not going to read it to you, but we are going to look at some of the quotes and things from here, and I'll lay out the context of what made me do this. So let's start with this. Is some of you may be familiar with the story of the so-called Unabomber and his manifesto. His name is Ted Kaczynski, and he is a convicted domestic terrorist currently serving in a supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. I think recently he's actually been moved because it was announced that he has, fatal terminal cancer and more than likely will not make it through the end of the year or, much longer beyond that. But he has been serving time in prison since 1995 after being a part of a bombing campaign from 1978 to 1995 across the United States, bombing different, sending bombs to different people like CEOs of certain companies and different organizations and things of that sort. And Ted Kaczynski was, you know, the story is, the sort of mainstream version of this story is that, you know, he was this weirdo loner who lived out in a, you know, in the woods in a cabin in Montana, and hated technology and hated everything, and hated society, and would go out and shoot, you know, his gun at planes, and would break into people's cabins to just, because he just hated people creeping in on his isolation out there in the woods. He was a boy genius, basically, at the age of 16. I think they said his IQ was around 160 something. And he went to Harvard at 16 years old, really just a brilliant person in the area of mathematics, and ended up becoming a professor at a really young age before breaking away and going to live in Montana. And then at some point decided to make his disdain for society and civilization and technology go beyond just reading, you know, radical environmentalist magazines like Earth First, and actually starting a bombing campaign. Now, without making this whole video about Ted Kaczynski, I will say, as typical with these situations, I think there's much more to that story than we're probably told. One thing that has come to light in the last couple of years is the fact that Ted Kaczynski was, we found out, a part of some sort of brainwashing experiment when he was a young kid, when he first went to Harvard for 2 years. And this whole story has come out even in the mainstream. There's a professor that was a part of another program connected to MKUltra. So there are some connections to some nefarious things. But this professor they put the young students like Ted Kaczynski in a specific building because they claimed it was going to help them, you know, not be isolated and whatnot. But in reality, they were running experiments on them, like a live experiment on these students to see how they would react to different stimuli. And apparently they describe like these sort of critical sessions of where they would talk to these kids and have them read off some poetry, right, or read off some writing they did, and then just critique it and attack it and really break them down and study. And they had them connected to different machines and studying their reaction and their biological responses to these sort of breaking them down therapy, right? Whatever the heck you want to call it. And Ted Kaczynski, as a young man, was involved with this therapy. And, you know, shortly after that, would break away from society. He claimed in his own words that it didn't have much impact on his life, but I think it's undeniable that something like that would definitely affect somebody. So I think another thing is that Ted Kaczynski was also, like many people, pressured to make a deal and to say, hey, admit guilt to all these different bombings and we won't put you to death. We'll just remove the death penalty from there, right? Because he didn't want to plead guilty. He wanted to defend himself and actually go to trial, and who knows what he would have said or what we would have learned. But instead, you know, they pleaded him out and he said he was guilty. But I do think that he seems to not really, I don't know. I think, like I said, there's more to the story, but the point is, he is a brilliant man. I don't agree with his tactics. Anybody who knows my work, you know, that I don't agree with the idea of insurrection or violence or, you know, trying to overthrow the state through these different violent means. But I do think that his critiques are absolutely important. In fact, my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State, which was published in January 30th, 2020, and predicted, you know, right before COVID, a lot of the things that are coming. I'm not saying that like I'm special. I'm saying there's people like Ted Kaczynski and many other anti-civilization, anti-tech, or not even anti-tech, but sort of critics of technology and the advancement of this. Even John Trudell, radical native activists, who've been critiquing the way that technology would impact us. And, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot since I wrote this article and reading Ted Kaczynski again, that for all the ways that technology has made us more connected, we now have, I can connect to people all over the world, have a global international audience, but at the same time, many of us feel even more isolated or, you know, more disassociative. And some of these things are things that Ted Kaczynski was writing and warning about. So yes, I wholeheartedly do not endorse, and I, you know, want nothing to do with his bombing campaign that I do think was bombing mostly just like innocent people. That's just not the way to achieve change. And really, he didn't even seem like he was doing this because he thought it was going to achieve radical change. He even knew that more than likely he was going to be caught. He was hoping that he wouldn't be taken alive, you know? So he was definitely off his rocker to some degree, but also a brilliant person in other ways. And so his words have been studied since this. You know, in 1995, right before he was caught, he was corresponding anonymously to the law enforcement. And he told them that if they published his manifesto, which was like 35,000 words, it was like a book basically. If they published his manifesto in the New York Times and Washington Post, then he would cease bombing. And if he didn't, then, you know, he would continue bombing. And he wanted the attention. He wanted his ideas to get out there. And so that manifesto is, the proper title is Industrial Society and Its Future. And again, this document has been studied now, and it's like, you can, there's college courses about it, about him, and he's been interviewed. He released another book in 2016, even though he's, you know, in supermax prison, he's still communicating with many people because people agree with his analysis, even if they don't agree with his solutions or his bombing campaign, right? But he warned about a lot of the things that we are seeing now. And so there's a new movie about his life you can find out there. It's not about his whole life, but it's about the period of time when he lived out in the cabin in the woods leading up to him getting arrested. It's called Ted K. You can stream it for free online. Just find it out there. You know the places to look. And I was watching it, and I know the story of him. I've known the story for a while. I've read through the manifesto in the past. And again, like, I also have concerns with, because I've written about this in my book, about the advancement of AI and facial recognition and social credit. These are things that I've been talking about for years. And yes, blockchain is part of that, the negative uses of blockchain when it comes to these type of things. So it's not like a radical idea at this point, but he was talking about this back in the 70s and into the 80s and into the 90s. And I watched the movie, and it really made me think, like, wow, this guy, he was right in some ways. Today's video is asking the question, was Ted Kaczynski right? And I think in some ways he was right. He was wrong to make, to use violence to try to achieve his goals or make his points. But I do think that he was correct that the concerns he had are very real and continue to be very real, and are now, we're at the point where we're actually seeing how this technology and the coming dystopia that many of us are warning against, the technocracy, which technocracy, for those who are unaware, is simply just the philosophy that society should be governed and organized by, essentially planned, socially engineered by the experts, the technological elite, the scientists, etc., not by the will of the people and the voting and things like that, even though there's problems with that. And I don't even believe in that system. It's not even that. It's not a monarchy. It's not a democracy. It's central planning, you know, and it's not communism. It's a bit more detailed than that. Right. So these people believe in this philosophy, and Kaczynski doesn't really focus on that aspect. He more focuses on some of the dangers of technology. Let's go ahead and get into this while we can. Again, thank you guys so much for following along here. If you want to, bookmark theconsciousresistance.com. You can find all of the work that we're doing here. You can find the source for this article we're about to cover here at thelastamericanvagabond.com. The coming terror of social impact finance and social credit scores. So here's a quote from the very beginning of Ted Kaczynski's Industrial Society and Its Future. The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased the life expectancy of those of us who live in advanced countries, but they have destabilized society, have made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, and have led to widespread psychological suffering in the third world, to physical suffering as well, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. It will probably lead to a greater social disruption and psychological suffering, and it may lead to increased physical suffering, even in so-called advanced societies. And I think that obviously he has a very dark view of technology. I think that what he just said is true. It's not the only truth that exists. It is true that technology can have that play those negative roles and have those negative impacts. But clearly technology has done a lot of good as well. Advancements in different types of technology that have made things easier and saved more lives and just all kinds of different things. But without a doubt, there are reasons to be critical of technology. We've believed for a long time that technology is supposed to make our lives simpler, easier, faster, et cetera. But in many ways, now we find ourselves more busy than ever. And it's questionable whether or not the things we're finding ourselves busy doing, these things, you know, via the internet and entertaining each other and trying to keep up with all this stuff going on, that influx of data, that overload of data, if it's actually more useful. Yes, we have more info because of the technology, but is that actually in the end making us more productive, more happy, etc.? I think that's up for debate. And this part, I just go through what Kaczynski, the story of Kaczynski, which we just talked about. Now, I wrote right here, for many millennials and Gen Z who grew up with the internet, or in some cases on the internet, the issues that Kaczynski speak to are very real. Isolation, what he called over-socialization, and disassociation. These experiences are familiar to many of the recent generations who spent their childhoods learning on computers, navigating the world filtered through memes, self-obsessed social media, and feeling the judgment or praise that comes with a life lived via the net. Numerous studies over the last decade have clearly highlighted the negative effects of spending too much time on the internet, comparing and contrasting our lives against largely fictionalized versions of other people's lives. This disassociation, along with mass surveillance, was exactly what Ted Kaczynski warned about. And then here I'd list another quote from his writing here. It says, quote, "The industrial technological system may survive or it may break down. If it survives, it may eventually achieve a low level of physical and psychological suffering, but only after passing through a long and very painful period of adjustment, and only at the cost of permanently reducing human beings and many other living organisms to engineered products and mere cogs in the social machine." And I think that's, again, a very, even that idea of being a wrench in the gear of the machine, it's like this sort of universal feeling among many humans in the modern age of the last couple of generations that we feel often like we are a cog in a big machine, like our life might not have meaning in its own, or we're just kind of stuck in this big machine lurching forward that even if many of us don't agree with or want to exist, we don't know how to stop or how to get out of, you know, how to get off the ride, so to speak. Furthermore, if the system survives, the consequences will be inevitable. There is no way of reforming or modifying the system so as to prevent it from depriving people of dignity and autonomy. If the system breaks down, the consequences will still be very painful, but the bigger the system grows, the more disastrous the results of its breakdown will be. So if it is to break down, it had best break down sooner rather than later. And again, that was from Ted Kaczynski's Industrial Society and Its Future, or often known as the Unabomber Manifesto. Excuse me while I sip some water real quick. Always necessary to have water on hand. The thoughts and actions of Kaczynski are likely to experience another surge in relevance and reflection with the recent release of the movie Ted K, which I just mentioned. So as I mentioned, after watching the movie, I began rereading Kaczynski's original manifesto and his 2016 book, Anti-Tech Revolution, Why and How. The difference between my previous studies of his words and this latest look at it is that now I'm interested in understanding Ted Kaczynski's work through the lens of the Great Reset and the rise of technocracy and the biosecurity state, which is, I think, where we're at now in a lot of the independent alternative media, as more and more people have woken up to the Great Reset, to the technocracy, the biosecurity state, to the vaccine passports as a gateway to a digital ID, as a gateway to social credit scores and social impact finance, which we're talking about today, and how all of those things collectively can lock you out of society if they choose to, if you're not playing the game, which is why it's more important than ever to get out of their systems. So by understanding the concerns of Kaczynski, is it possible to better comprehend the dangers posed to us by rapidly emerging digital technologies such as AI, biometrics, facial recognition databases, and the technocratic philosophy which guides the Great Reset Initiative? This essay is the first of several efforts to understand the coming threat of these technologies, specifically social credit scores and social impact finance, in relation to the warnings of the brilliant but fractured mind of Ted Kaczynski. So that's kind of my intro to that there. And if you have thoughts, guys, I am going to be checking the comments on all the platforms, Odyssey, Rockfin, DLive, and Facebook and all that good stuff. So I do think that this is kind of setting the stage for what we're getting into now. Social credit scores, I feel like, is a topic I don't have to explain too deeply to most of you. I'm going to just, rather than read this part of the article, I can probably better explain it on my own. But there are a couple of kind of introductions into this concept that I want to share with you. And this is, again, that Kaczynski was warning about the dangers of the use of digital technology in a way that forces humans to mold themselves into the machine. This is what I was saying before. Like, we feel like we're a part of a machine. You know, we often use that terminology, and that we have to adapt our lives to this machine and conform to it to certain degrees in order to have a quote unquote normal life, as opposed to the idea that machines, technology, digital technology could be molded to the desires and the benefits of humanity, which is what I think many of us believe it's for, that technology is here to make the lives of the humans better. But maybe in some sense, the predator class is and has been using digital technology as a tool for, of course, distractions, et cetera, but also creating this world, this digital world, like, you know, sandbox for us to play in. And within that sandbox, there are rules, of course, right? So that means if they say you have to get a shot for COVID-19 in order to open a bank account, which could happen and has happened in parts of the world, then you have to do that if you want to participate in that system, right? I've been just recognizing this more and more as I've been, as I mentioned earlier, getting out of PayPal and getting out of these systems and realizing there are certain things like a podcasting service or paying for web hosting and certain things that are more difficult without having a debit card or a PayPal account or bank account. I don't have those things. And I haven't had bank accounts since 2008. And it's very difficult to operate in that fashion, almost impossible, right? You have to make compromises or jump through a bunch of hoops to make it work. And that is what they want. That's just with paying a bill, right? But my point with sharing that is that the more things go pass on into this technocratic world, the more difficult it will be for you to get out of these systems. This is why the goal, the idea, at least that I'm trying to spread right now, is that while you have the opportunity, get out of the banking systems, start, you know, if you're interested in crypto, precious metals, alternative currencies, stuffing your mattress with your money, investing in tools, resources, learning new skills, using that money, et cetera. These are all better ideas than just leaving your money in the bank. And as we're seeing with the situation in Canada, people's bank accounts being seized and funds being frozen, this is the danger of just leaving yourself in that system. If you're in their system and you're dependent on it, they can and will freeze you out. And that's what social credit scores are about, right? So before we talk about that real quick, let me read you this section here. Kaczynski warned about the dangers of using digital technology in a way that forces human beings to mold themselves to the machine as opposed to molding the machines to benefit the humans. When he writes, quote, "Our society tends to regard as a sickness any mode of thought or behavior that is inconvenient for the system. And this is plausible because when an individual doesn't fit into the system, it causes pain to the individual as well as problems for the system. Thus, the manipulation of an individual to adjust him to the system as seen as a cure for a sickness and therefore as a good." And so I said, when he writes that, he speaks to a feeling that many people before him and since him have discussed. And just again, clarify, he's saying that like our society thinks that you're sick if you are not adjusting well to this fucked up world that we live in. And I think that many of us have understood that this idea of the matrix, that some maybe people inherently feel like something's wrong in the world. Something's not right. This is not, there's injustices. And why are people just turning a blind eye to all these different things? And for many of us as children or growing up, it's really difficult to try to understand that. Even if this is going on a subconscious kind of below the surface level, I think that often happens. And then that can create a state of like imbalance and concern. And maybe people turn to drugs or distractions because they don't know why things don't make sense. Right. And it's because we are trying to adjust ourselves to this system, which is inherently sick and twisted itself. So as he says here, the manipulation of an individual to adjust him to the system is seen as the cure. So it's not that let's figure out what's the root of your thing and maybe it's the fucked up world. No, it's okay, well, let's dope you up or drug you or something to figure out a way to make you adjusted to our sick society. And what I wrote here is that perhaps most famously, Krishnamurti said, quote, "It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. However, this is exactly what most of the human population is encouraged to do. Find a way to find balance within the increasingly imbalanced, unstable world we live in. While the digital infrastructure is erected around us, we are compelled to comply or be left behind. And of course, this infrastructure also includes government agencies with rapidly increasing police and surveillance powers, distractions in the form of television, social media, and other forms of entertainment, and a culture which promotes the use of mind-altering pharmaceuticals as a method of escape from the drudgery of the profoundly sick society." So I think that those are pretty positive, like, or not positive, but they're pretty important, poignant points that Kaczynski was making in his writing. This is an area where Kaczynski might be most prescient, is his prediction that society would compel people to change their behaviors and actions to suit the needs of the technological system. And this can be seen most clearly with the introduction of social engineering programs such as social credit scores. And in this part of the article, I go into referencing an article I wrote, I think in 2020-2021, called Social Credit Scores Are Already Here. And in this, I found this investigation showing that millions of people around the world have already been denied home loans or apartments or jobs, because increasingly these different companies, whether they're looking for, you know, applicants for jobs or new people to live in their apartments, et cetera, things like that, that they're using third-party services that essentially put together and compile a rating, a trust score, based on going out there and analyzing all of your social media data, your, you know, arrest record, all kinds of different things, comparing that. They have their own little algorithm, and then they produce, here's a rating number for this company, for this person. And so this isn't a governmental social credit score, but this is already existing with private companies, and individuals are going out and they're hiring, or yeah, they're hiring these types of companies to say, hey, can you provide us scores for our applicants or for our potential employees or for our potential tenants and apartment buildings and things like that. And people are in some cases being denied or of course approved based on those scores. So you're already having a social credit score applied to you coming from the private sector. That's not the governmental system just yet, but these things are already happening. So I talked about that. I also talked about that since 2009, many of you know that the Chinese government has been installing the Sesame credit system, a social credit system across the Chinese nation. And their plan is in the coming years to have it nationwide, where they penalize people or reward people based on their actions. So if you do things that are seen as antisocial, like maybe protesting the government or questioning COVID-19 or not wearing masks and things like that, then your scores can go down. You can be punished. And not just that, but the people near you, their social credit scores can go down because they're associating with you, an antisocial person, right? And maybe you say, well, who cares? It's just a number, right? They're giving me some score. I don't care. I don't need the government. But what's happened in the last couple of years, millions of Chinese citizens have already been denied their right to travel, to fly out of their own country because their score was too low. And thus the things that used to be known as rights are now being seen as privileges, and privileges can be taken away. And in this case, it's happening, right? So if you litter, if you don't pay your taxes on time, if you, you know, if you jaywalk, one of the millions of facial recognition cameras with AI algorithms are going to scan you, immediately see you, plaster your face on digital billboards all around, and your social credit score will go down. So this can also affect you, because if your score is low, you might be turned down for jobs, again, denied the ability to travel, and just general social. People don't want to hang around other people who have a low score. This is what technocracy is all about: using technology to socially engineer and centrally plan society. This is what we're witnessing, guys. And this is what social credit scores are already happening in places like China. Also, I would look to the digital nation of Estonia, for places that are starting to experiment with some of these things. And it is going to come into fruition in the coming years. And yes, the vaccine passports are just a step in that direction. And even though right now the narrative might seem like it's focused on Russia and other things, or it seems like, okay, some of the states are repealing their mandates and going backwards, it doesn't mean that the Agenda 2030 or the Great Reset or any of these plans are going away. It just means that they're shifting the narrative for one reason or another that is unknown to us at the moment. But the point is, the vaccine passports are the first step towards an all-encompassing digital ID. Eventually, a digital ID you're going to need just to access the internet. And eventually, this will be tied to a social credit score. Again, this social credit score also might determine how much food you're allowed to get in the future, right? And this sounds very crazy to some people, but this is a reality. This is what this article is talking about. This is some of the things that Ted Kaczynski was warning about. Most of you might have heard about these kinds of things via the TV show. What was it called? Black Mirror, where, you know, there's like a reference to some of these ideas of social credit and other things like that. But the truth is, reality is stranger than fiction, right? So let me go here and let's read from the article again. I want to show you guys this section. When understood in the context of COVID-1984, it's fairly easy to see how concepts like social credit scores can be used to punish those who reject vaccines and similar therapies. For example, let's say you are one of the people who refuse to wear masks in public. Once one of the thousands of facial recognition cameras scan your face, they will send the face print to a local data analysis center and immediately identify you while deducting points from your social credit score. The government and partner corporations might also broadcast your photo and identity to your local surroundings, individual phones, and digital billboards to alert the people that they are in the presence of anti-science, anti-social, anti-mask idiot, right? So think about that. again, you're not wearing a mask in public. Maybe this is mandated or it's just frowned upon. Camera scans you, sees your face. Oh, you receive an update immediately. Hey, you've lost 5 points on your social credit score for violating the local mandate. They take a picture. Then it's all around the local digital billboards right where you're at, because they know exactly where you are, showing people, hey, this person isn't masked up. You know, don't hang out near them. And people have an immediate response. This is a reality already in some parts of the world, and it will happen elsewhere. These types of actions have the effect of taking away state-sanctioned privileges, travel in China, for example, and stigmatizing the individual amongst their local community. This is because associating with an individual with a low social credit score can also cause one's own score to drop, as we discussed. And so I wrote this, and I think this is worth noting, that look, I am very concerned about these types of technology. You can find my work going back to my 5G documentary in 2018, 2019, but all of my work over the last years about 5G, talking about the positive and negative use cases of blockchain and digital currency for years, and more recently talking about social credit scores. Of course, my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. Look, I've been about this. I understand this issue, right? But some people out there take a very black and white, and I think a childish, naive approach, and say all technology is bad, right? But the reality is these are just tools. So what I wrote here is that it's worth noting that in a different world, a sane world, there might be a multitude of positive use cases for something similar to a social credit score that provides accurate and useful data about the people and companies around us. In many ways, humans already accumulate and spend social credit in our current relationships. For example, when a person develops a reputation as a liar or a thief, word spreads around. Community members become aware of the antisocial habit and began to spread the word to other community members who associate with this person. From there, each individual can decide how they want to use the new data and whether or not they want to continue to associate with the antisocial individual. When participation and social credit scores schemes is voluntary, consensual, and private, it could help individuals make better decisions about in their daily lives. And I stand by that 100%. I think if you think about this in terms of like Yelp, right? Yelp is basically just a private service that exists and says, hey, like, there's a need out here. People want to know more about the restaurants they're going to go to. Okay, well, we're just going to be a place that hosts reviews about different types of restaurants, right? People can come here and share their thoughts and take, you know, pictures and things like that. That's a private form of social credit, right? These restaurants are trying to do a good job because they know people are going to share this publicly, and they have websites now and Google reviews and other things like that, or just Facebook or whatever, to take pictures and say, look how crappy this food is, or look at this crappy service, you know, don't come back here. And they know that that's a form of social credit. And the idea is that things like that, in the best way, again, voluntary, consensual, it's not being run by the government, nobody's going to die over it or lose their food, that it encourages better behavior. Because if the companies out there on Yelp are seeing that people are giving them bad reviews, and they're like, damn, this is getting the public, this is a long thread about how much our food sucks, then they're going to want to improve that, right? So the idea would be, again, you might have a community, let's say a community of 200 people decides to adopt a digital ID within, or digital kind of like ecosystem within their community that they all sign into, like a message board system, a chat network, things of that sort. And they come up with a way, I don't know, I'm not trying to get too detailed about it, but they come up a way to assign social credit to each other based on different factors that they decide. You know, this would all have to be figured out. In that way, that's just happening within the community. And people might use that number to say, hey, so-and-so's got, you know, 90 points because they've done all these really amazing things for the community. And that doesn't mean they can control your lives or they get to, you know, rule over you or anything like that. It just is, can be a way to understand better about each other, and also maybe a way to encourage positive behavior. That's just, maybe that's too optimistic, but I just think that it's worth noting that it's not all black and white. But as I wrote here, unfortunately, we live in a world where men and women in positions of authority exercise their power by attempting to control the lives of the masses using digital technology and propaganda. This means governments with a track record of authoritarianism and deception, and corporations with less than trustworthy histories, are the likely architects of the social credit schemes of the near future. It would be a mistake and a simplistic analysis to assume that every single company, government, or individual expressing interest in some element of social credit is a tool for the Great Reset. The reality is that certain individuals believe they can use the concept of social credit scores to encourage positive, empowering behavior. However, we must ask, who is the judge of what behavior constitutes positive and negative? And that's where things get real sticky, is that, like, okay, you can say, yeah, this could be a tool for doing good, and you encourage people to volunteer in their community and to clean up and all kinds of different ideas out there. People have talked about like, hey, you document, here I am cleaning up the beach. And then that gets stored on like a community message board that could be on a blockchain. And that rewards you with some like community tokens for doing good things. And those can be traded for, you know, there's all kinds of ideas that don't have to be nefarious and like, oh my God, we're being starved out by the beast, right? But most of the people in power with access to this technology and working on it are planning on doing some really fucked up things with it. I hope you guys are still with me. We're 35 minutes in. I'm still about to get into social impact finance, social impact investing. This is an extremely important part. I'm gonna try to make it super simple and not glaze over. So, you know, not make your eyes glaze over so you can actually understand this. We've talked about social credit score. Give me some thumbs up, hearts, comments, wherever you're watching, if this is making sense, whether you're watching this live or later. Let me know what you're thinking. What do you think about social credit scores and how that is being rolled out now? Do you see it in relation to the vaccine passport schemes? Do you understand how those things are going to work together? Let's go ahead and jump into this second section here on social impact finance. So social impact finance, a tool for positive outcomes or for social manipulation. And here's another quote that I put from Ted Kaczynski. Modern man is strapped down by a network of rules and regulations, and his fate depends on the actions of persons remote from him whose decisions he cannot influence. This is not accidental or a result of the arbitrariness of arrogant bureaucrats. It is necessary and inevitable in any technologically advanced society. The system has to regulate human behavior closely in order to function. And this part I think is really important. The system has to force people to behave in ways that are increasingly remote from the natural pattern of human behavior. For example, the system needs scientists, mathematicians, and engineers. It can't function without them. So heavy pressure is put on children to excel in these fields. It isn't natural for an adolescent human being to spend the bulk of his time sitting at a desk absorbed in study. The system does not and cannot exist to satisfy human needs. Indeed, it is human behavior that has to be modified to fit the needs of the system. This has nothing to do with the political or social ideology that may pretend to guide the technological system. It is the fault of the technology because the system is guided not by ideology, but by technical necessity. And like, whoa, I think those are just super powerful thoughts and words there. I hope you caught that. So what I wrote here was, if social credit scores are a tool that can be used for good or ill, then social impact finance is the infrastructure upon which social credit scores will rest. This abstract, unassuming financial instrument has the potential to be an unseen force which coerces people to act in ways which serve the system rather than the people. The terms social impact finance, social impact bonds, social impact investing, pay for success, or simply impact investing describe a specific investment strategy that ostensibly aims to benefit society or the environment in a positive way, in addition to reaping financial gains. So again, this part, I definitely want you guys to go read, because I think reading it for yourself will do better justice than I can do for you here just by reading it. But essentially, social impact bonds or social impact financing involves using financial investments from, let's say, philanthropists who want to do good in the world, or at least claim to want to do good in the world. They can say, I want to invest in a bond that is going to go help elementary kids in poor Black communities, right? And I'm willing to give this many millions of dollars. And if they're basically going to replace government money and say, hey, we're going to invest private $5 million into this. And if we can prove within a year, based on various measurements and factors, that, you know, the grades have improved, or more kids have, you know, less kids have dropped out, or whatever measurements you're trying to achieve, then the person gets their principal investment and they also can reap profits on top of that. And ideally, then good happens in the world. So it's like, okay, a rich person did something good. They get to feel good about it. They make some money on the top of it. And something good was done in the world. That's the best version case scenario of these kinds of things: social impact financing, social impact bonds, impact investing, things like that. But also, as we just discussed with social credit scores, when you put these things together, you can easily see how it can be done in a way to try to socially engineer certain behaviors. Just like we saw with the 2008 financial crisis, how we learned how there were certain financial sectors that were literally making money betting on whether or not people were going to lose their homes. In some cases, they bet, okay, this person might be able to hold their home. In this case, they're probably going to lose it, but I'm going to bet maybe both ways. Maybe you hedge your bets and both bet on both sides so they can win either way. And to many people, it's just sickening, disgusting, the idea that there's people making money off other people's losses, you know, or their struggles. And this is that to a whole new degree, right? Because you can have this unseen force that will exist that could be, you know, just, oh, it looks like my camera's about to die. Let me switch cameras real quick. You have this unseen force that could basically just be betting on your life, and you could be making lots of different, you know, making lots of different money on your back and, you know, behind the scenes without you ever even realizing this is going on. Right. So again, imagine, let me see what examples I can give here from the article here. I'll read this part. It says social impact bonds are unique public-private partnerships that fund effective social services through performance-based contracts. Impact investors provide the capital to scale the work of high quality service providers. Government repays those investors if and when the project achieves outcomes that generate public value, whether they are focused on helping mothers experiencing poverty achieve healthy births, supporting immigrants and refugees through job training, or retrofitting homes. Social impact bonds transfer risk from the public to the private sector and align project partners on the achievement of meaningful impact. So that's, of course, like the flowery language way they're going to explain it. And it's important to understand that the term public-private partnerships, these kinds of terms that we're hearing increasingly, this is essentially describing the merger of corporate and state power, which, you know, some people like a man named Mussolini talked about the merger of corporate and state power as something he called fascism. I'm not saying that's what it is, but that's just what some people have talked about historically. And you should know that the World Economic Forum themselves, they call themselves the International Organization for public-private partnerships. So they consider themselves like that's their whole reason for existing. So again, something like social impact bonds is being promoted like a positive thing, that this is going to allow rich people who want to do good out there in the world to do that and to, you know, help people out using their funds and their money. Now, I don't take such an optimistic view of this, but that's the way they want us to understand it. Now, here's some deeper levels that are important to understand. These types of investments are part of a growing trend where corporations seeking to rebrand themselves spend large amounts of money to prove their efforts. In this way, companies can claim to be expanding their social responsibility and increasing their involvement in community and social issues. One specific method for measuring the success of these programs is to base them on environmental, social, and governance criteria. This is known as ESG. ESG investing is also sometimes referred to as sustainable investing, responsible investing, or social responsible investing, SRI. The practice has become an increasingly popular way to promote the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which, of course, of those are also Agenda 2030, the 2030 agenda from the United Nations. Environmental, social, and governance standards give socially conscious investors an opportunity to screen which types of corporations they want to endorse. So all of this is to say that they're using these types of standards to push their narrative about creating a more diverse, equitable, environmentally friendly world. But overall, what we're seeing here, guys, is that this is going to be, once again, an unseen structure existing sort of behind the scenes that will dictate how people do business, that will also dictate how we live our lives, right? Because it's going to tell us that right now they're talking about this in terms of we're going to use this to measure corporations to make sure corporations do good in the world. But no. This is going to be applied to you as well. You, the individual, are you living up to the environmental standards, the social standards, the governance standards, and these sort of other measurements that they might put up there, right? And if you're not, then that's where social credit can come in and punish you for that. Once again, it should be reiterated that the publicly promoted aim of these tools is to advance the public interest. In this best case scenario, a wealthy philanthropist who truly cares about the state of the environment and advancing equity amongst corporations decides which companies to invest in based on their ESG standards. This philanthropist sees a chance to do good in the world with her money, so she participates in a social impact bond, which promises to produce higher grades among elementary children at an inner city school. If the SIB program delivers, the philanthropist receives her principal investment plus a financial reward. In this situation, the children in the school are empowered and the investor is as well. However, the reality appears to be starkly different than this imagined best case scenario. Let's imagine the social impact investor actually wanted to bet that the elementary school children would fail and not achieve higher grades. In that situation, an investor might be incentivized to discourage positive outcomes and instead seek a profit by encouraging negative outcomes. And if this sounds preposterous, again, remember that in the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, investors were using financial tools to make profits off the losses and bankruptcies of the individual homeowners. So There, I go into some history of this. There's a writer named Tim Scott writing for Dissident Voices, which has been talking about this back in 2016, doing some really good work showing how, as I talked about in the Pyramid of Power, how the philanthropists, and in the coming up season three, we're going to be talking about the nonprofit industrial complex, how a lot of these rich, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, and now the Bill Gates of the world, they use philanthropy as a way to not only hide their money and, you know, fund all kinds of things, but to gain more power, but to remake their image and to make it look like they're these really just good people out there trying to do good in the world, right? And these financial tools are, these new financial tools, social impact investing, are all a part of the same thing. It's just kind of remaking their image. And he does some really good writing here. He talks about how that it was actually the Rockefeller Foundation back in 2007 that helped create the social impact finance, social impact investing school of thought. They organized two meetings of leaders of finance and philanthropy to build the structural framework for an efficient worldwide social and environmental impact investment industry. Those in attendance agreed to a global network of leading impact investors, as well as a standardized framework for assessing social and environmental impact. So the results of these meetings was the creation of something called the Global Impact Investment Network in 2009, which is a nonprofit tax-exempt organization based in the U.S. And this organization, the Global Impact Investment Network, includes Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Ford Foundation, Deutsche Bank, and on and on and on and on. Many of the power players who are a part of this so-called stakeholder capitalism, who are part of the World Economic Forum, who are part of the Great Reset agenda. So back in 2007, the Rockefellers convened some meetings. These meetings lead to the launch of the Global Impact Investment Network in 2009. And all the usual players, the usual suspects are involved in that. And now for the last decade, they've been pushing that towards this, what they call stakeholder capitalism. And then, of course, in 2020, they announced the push for the Great Reset. So lots going on here, guys. I hope you're still with me, because I got some important final points here as we talk about, now that we've explained some of Ted Kaczynski's warnings, we've talked about social credit scores, now I've explained what social impact finance is, I want to just spend a moment showing the intersection of these things, and specifically from statements made by Charles Hoskinson at the World Economic Forum in January 2020. Who is Charles Hoskinson? He's the co-founder of the Ethereum blockchain and the founder of the Cardano blockchain, which many people in the crypto world are very hyped about. So he gave a short presentation that doesn't look like he was, you know, he wasn't speaking with Klaus Schwab. It looks like he's in some small side room. I think that's important for people to understand that not everybody who's ever spoken at the World Economic Forum is necessarily a part of the Great Reset. It's a big event with the main events and all these kind of side rooms. Doesn't mean people are sitting there hanging out with Klaus Schwab per se, but they do try to recruit people, as we know. So I think that's important. But it's also important to judge people by what they say. And Charles Hoskinson in 2020, right before COVID hit, he gave a short presentation about how blockchain is going to impact the future. And he's talking specifically about social impact finance and social credit scores and how they interact with blockchain ledgers. He talks about how blockchains can track the production of a coffee plant from field to factory, allowing for true accountability and transparency for corporations, investors, and customers. Then he explains that investors who want to know their funds are going to do good in the world have limited ability to follow the money at present. He says, quote, how do you track that? How do you trace that? How do you make sure the money is actually going to the right hands? Hoskinson then goes on to explain how the governments of Ethiopia and Georgia are tracking and tracing the use of tax revenue to make sure that it goes to the proper departments, and how the same technology could be used to track and trace donations or investments. He speaks of a global citizenship with a, quote, self-sovereign identity that can be connected to a property portfolio with a reputation rating, which is a social credit score, and a payment system. And he says, quote, so you can now directly pay people who are registered, and you can track and chase what they do with those funds. He claims that his goal is to build a, quote, global stock market or global venture capital for the poorest people in the world. How does he plan to do so? First, upgrade the countries, implement the so-called sovereign identity, and, quote, pair that with the tracking and traceability and the ability to know that people are spending money correctly. This, he promises, will create some of the, quote, safest, most auditable investments in the world for the poorest people in the world in the next 10 to 20 years. Of course, he just kind of throws into the statement of, like, you know, tracking and tracing, making sure people are spending the money correctly, the right way. And I get the idea of accountability, that if somebody's donating, you want to make sure you're not just giving to some organization and that it's not actually helping poor kids in Africa or whatever you think it's doing, or, you know, inner city children or whatever the case may be. You want to know that, look, oh, here's my money. We can show the full record of where it went. And here's the results of it. It's actually something good came out of that, right? I get that idea. But when it goes beyond that, it starts being applied to the public in general and life at large, then we get really dangerous. So before we talk about the sovereign self identity, I think it's important to go deeper. What is he describing? He envisions a world where social impact investors place their money into programs which they allegedly believe will improve the planet or a specific local population. They do so with the hopes that they believe they receive their initial investment plus some gained profit. Then, as outlined by Hoskinson, you can partner these investments with technology that allows for tracking and tracing of individuals' purchases to make sure they are, quote, spending money correctly, i.e., according to the terms set by social impact investors as part of their original arrangement. For example, if a philanthropist contributes to a program to help out recipients of welfare programs, they might like the opportunity to track and trace the use of their funds from investment all the way to the individual recipient. If a person on Social Security receives their funds via a social impact bond or a company or a board of investors, might eventually determine that the individual's lifestyle is not conducive to positive outcomes. So when combined with a reputation system, as called for by Hoskinson, this could mean that welfare recipients are punished by their lifestyle choices if deemed detrimental to the goals of the social impact bond. This is the type of social engineering that is possible with social credit scores and social impact finance infrastructure. So I hope that makes sense. And honestly, for those of you who've been around for a minute, you might remember a documentary called From Freedom to Fascism. If not, I encourage you to go onto Odyssey or BitChute or one of those platforms and search it, and you can find it. It came out in 2006. And there's a whole scene that basically predicts all of this, that all the systems were going to be so interconnected that, you know, your insurance company was going to know if you've been eating pizza, and then that would affect your ability to get a good insurance rate because all those different systems were connected, or you'd have to pay all these extra fees. And this is kind of what they're talking about here. Now, I want to talk about this use of sovereign, because I know that people like Alison McDowell and others have really tried to make it seem like the word sovereign is a bad thing. I think that's silly, but it is clear that people like the World Economic Forum, IBM, the Sovereign Foundation, and Charles Hoskinson are using this terminology of self-sovereign identity or sovereign self-identity, which was a project launched by IBM and involves the creation of a privately held identity, which is owned by the individual as opposed to a government-sanctioned identification. And this is achieved by individuals securely storing their own identity data on their personal devices and providing it to those who need to validate it without relying on a central repository like a government. In this situation, the individuals must consent to the sharing of their identities or any related data. Once again, it is a technology that has the potential to eliminate the need for government and central authorities, if done in a way that respects individual privacy and autonomy. However, it appears the organizations behind the concept are part of the same cabal of technocrats racing towards a great reset. So again, in 2018, IBM partnered with Sovereign Foundation to accelerate the push towards this sovereign self-identity. Sovereign Foundation describes itself as they're filling the need for such an identity, and that blockchain ledgers make it possible to have a private ID that interacts with public governmental systems. So they're promising that it's going to be a private ID, but that can interact with government systems and other systems while still being private and self-owned. Whether that's true or not, we'll have to wait to see. Then in 2018, they announced that the World Economic Forum was also partnering with the Sovereign Foundation to bring about this digital identity program. And the World Economic Forum, their goals around the digital identity align with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals on establishing digital identity for all people by 2030. So again, I think that there could be some positive use cases for such a non-state private ID. And you might say, what are a positive use case for this, Derek? I'm saying that in many cases, you might want to have proof to show, hey, this is who I am. I'm a person. I have a history. I have a reputation. And I want to use that, but not something that says, here's my US ID that I'm owned by the government of the United States, but just says that I'm a person and this is who I am. This is my name. This is whatever things I want to share. And it can be verified and trusted in some kind of way. And that's what I think people are imagining. And that could be used in a positive way like that, because I would like to be free of government IDs and have it accepted that even some non-state, non-governmental ID could allow you to be like, it'll be like a non-state passport that would still be accepted by states and organizations because it would be verified in some different way. And in this case, they're imagining via a blockchain. So the Sovereign Foundation's own white paper called The Inevitable Rise of Self-Sovereign Identity elaborates how this private identity would be adapted to fit social credit and social impact finance schemes. So that is to be clear that like the Sovereign Foundation seems like they're okay with social credit. And again, maybe they're talking about this way of private social credit, like I was talking about earlier, but they're also partnering with IBM and the World Economic Forum. So I don't trust it. For one, the foundation makes it clear that digital technologies such as blockchain are what, quote, finally makes self-sovereign identity possible. And they outline how this could be identified with a reputation economy. From their white paper, as an individual's or organization's sovereign identity builds up over time, so does their reputation. Stepping up from a low trust level to a higher trust level happens seamlessly as more verified attributes and claims are accumulated by the identity owner. This reputation becomes an asset of the identity owner. For example, an individual may choose to reveal their reputation to others to reestablish and reinforce trust, and an organization may publish its sovereign-based reputation ratings as a badge of honor. So, again, they talk about diffuse and distributed and preventing any single system organization from being able to turn off the ID. But again, their partnerships with IBM and World Economic Forum seem to hide an ulterior motive. But what I wrote here is the worst part of this whole sovereign self-identity is that plays on the use of the word sovereign, which in recent years has come to be associated with the truth and health freedom movements, especially in the context of COVID-1984. However, this corruption of language is par for the course for the predator class. Just as the elitists at the World Economic Forum and the UN mask their agendas with the use of the words like sustainable, diverse, equitable, etc., they are now attempting to hijack the language of individual liberty and bodily autonomy. This does not mean we cannot or should not use these words, but rather that we should fight to ensure their meaning is truly understood. If we do not fight to preserve the true meaning of these powerful words, we are allowing the technocrats to continue their word manipulation, doublespeak, and sanity. If we are not careful, these criminals will erase and pervert the meaning of these concepts so that future generations do not know what it means to be a sovereign, autonomous human being. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at. I'm going to just end. I'm going to read you the final three paragraphs of this, guys. And I know I've been at this for just about an hour. I appreciate your time. This is, I sent out an email today. I posted on my social media saying like, hey, I'm doing a really important video tonight about this new article. I wouldn't typically spend this long on a video, but it's important that I think we understand these things. And I'm not the first person to talk about these at all, but I think that the way I put it together with talking about Ted Kaczynski and some of the current manifestations of that is really important for you to understand. So here's the final part. Which world of the future are we creating? There's much more that I can say on this topic, and I'm going to expand upon this in future articles. For now, it's important to note that Ted Kaczynski anticipated the plans of Zbigniew Brzezinski and his technotronic era, and what many now refer to as technocracy. For those who don't understand that reference, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the guy who helped fund Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, who was, you know, friends with Kissinger and Obama and has just been a globalist, been around forever. Now his daughter's spewing propaganda at MSNBC. He wrote a book called Between Two Ages, The Technotronic Era, that describes a lot of what we're facing and dealing with now. And I write about that in my own book too. Kaczynski used the word technophiles to identify those who are blindly pushing towards the fourth industrial revolution and the age of merging man with machine. Additionally, I would point to the words of radical native activist John Trudell during the late 1960s and 70s. Trudell called the world we are standing at the precipice of the technologic world and warned about the dangers of forsaking nature in favor of an all-encompassing digital reality. These and many other thinkers of the last 100 years have warned us about the exact situation we now find ourselves in. Determining where humanity goes from this point on will be the task of all the currently living generations and the generations to come. The world of the future, the world of our grandchildren, is being directly shaped by our actions and inaction. We can see the writing on the wall, and we can see the end of a free humanity. To be sure, the fight is not over. It has only just begun. But we, humanity as a whole, will decide what the world of the future looks like for the next generations. Will humanity find a balance of nature and digital technology, striking harmony between permaculture, indigenous wisdom, and emerging technologies? Or will we fall prey to the desire to use these tools to forget about our humanity and falsely believe we can escape the limitations of our human existence? Each of us must answer these questions for ourselves and our communities. And as I outlined in my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State, I believe the only long-term solution is to exit from these technocratic systems and build systems which align with our values and principles. And while I wholeheartedly reject the acts of violence used by Ted Kaczynski, I echo his call for more attention and awareness on the dangers of this pervasive digital technology, guys. So that is my latest article for The Last American Vagabond called The Coming Terror of Social Impact Finance and Social Credit Scores. You can find it linked in all the videos, wherever you're watching right now, below. You can find it there. And I appreciate you giving some attention and some time with me and for me tonight on this important topic, because That article is about 4,700 words. Again, it's linked wherever you're watching right now. And I encourage you to read it and to share it with your social media circles so more people can understand it. You know, I know that other people have talked about social impact finance and some of these things, but I find personally for me that some other writers out there can get a little bit lost in the minutia and the detail. And the average person might not even fully understand or grasp the topic or even have a need to know the name of every single person connected to every single company. You know, you just want to get to the meat of the topic. And even though my article came out to be about 4,700 words, I do believe that I was able to do that and get to the point and get to the meat of how social impact finance and social credit can interact together and how people like Ted Kaczynski have been warning about these things for, you know, decades now. So it's a scary prospect that we're facing. It's really kind of crazy that this is right on the horizon, guys. This is a reality. This is why I wrote my book. By the way, you can download the book, theconsciousresistance.com/how-to, theconsciousresistance.com/how-to, if you want to pick up a copy of the How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. But I don't know that we can stop this. I've been saying this for a while now. I don't know that we can 100% stop the racing, impending doom of the technocratic state and Agenda 2030. I do believe that we can survive and thrive outside of their systems, and that we can try to, you know, find ways to not need them and to live free of them, right? So that is kind of what I've been focused on. That's what agorism is about. That's what counter economics is about. That's what the exit and build strategy and idea is all about, guys. That's what I've been putting my life's work into, is encouraging you guys to get out of the banking system, to get your kids out of the mainstream corporate slave education system, to get out of their propaganda media systems, to get out of, you know, the economic system, use alternative currencies, right? This is more important than ever. And again, this is what we're seeing with what's happening in Canada and elsewhere. You can see the way that if people don't get vaccinated, they're blocked out of society. That's the beginnings of social credit, guys. And this is, you know, that's just reputation, people being rude. Wait till it's a fully erected digital prison all around us that can lock you out if you say the wrong things or do the wrong thing. Wait till everything is tokenized. And if you don't have the right tokens for that day, you can't get your ration, right? Because, I mean, because the AI says so, because the algorithm says so. This is the world that is right here in front of us. This is the world that Ted Kaczynski, John Trudell, and many other thinkers have been warning about for decades. So again, the article is listed at The Conscious Resistance, at thelastamericanvagabond.com, or any of the places you're watching, you can go there and you can see the link below. I will remind you one more time before I get out of here. My website is theconsciousresistance.com, guys, theconsciousresistance.com. We launched a version 3.0 recently. If you want to see where to support us, go to theconsciousresistance.com/invest. Send me something to the P.O. box. Love mail, hate mail. I haven't got anything in my P.O. box yet. I'm excited for the first things to come in. Send me love mail, hate mail, gifts, tools you're not using, equipment, whatever you got. I'd love to use it and make use of it. Bookmark our website. Follow us on all of our social media platforms, guys. I've greatly appreciate your support. And until next time, my friends, remember, you are powerful, you're beautiful, and you are free. Peace.
Since 2012, the Conscious Resistance Network has been an independent media organization focused on empowering individuals through education, philosophy, health, and community organizing. We work to create a world where corporate and state power do not rule over the lives of free human beings. Our motto is leading by example and helping others in their pursuit of freedom. Visit theconsciousresistance.com to find our articles, documentaries, interviews, podcasts, books, and more. Remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.